This is a CBC podcast. Hey, kids, enter the TD Kids Book Club contest, and you could win a visit to your school from one of the TD Canadian Children's Literature Award nominees. And CBC Radio will be there to put it on the air. Visit cbc.ca/kidsbookclub for details. Contest only in selected cities.
Hi, I'm Brent Bambry. This is Q, the podcast. Highlights from the October 7th edition of Q, the program. I'm Brent Bambry, sitting in for Gian Gomeshi on the program today. Henry Winkler, producer, director, author, and of course, actor, a giant of 1970s television, The Fonz is on the show. Getting to know the Wiggles, the Australian superstars of the preschool set, massively successful. How do they do what they do? Plus, Outrage, a new documentary on how gay Americans' worst political enemy is the closeted gay politician. Director Kirby Dick joins me first up. This is Q. It's not news that the media are obsessed with the personal lives and sexual indiscretions of high-profile public figures. But when it comes to politicians and the closet, the door is usually closed. In Kirby Dick's new documentary film Outrage, the Academy Award-nominated director puts the lives of secretly gay American politicians in the spotlight. These are public officials who are gay or engage in gay sex, but regularly oppose legislation that advances gay rights. Sexual hypocrisy has been a theme for Kirby Dick, whose films include 1986's Private Practices, about the work of a sex surrogate, 2004's Twist of Faith, about pedophilia in the Ohio priesthood, and This Film Is Not Rated, which is about the hypocrisy of the movie rating system. Outrage debuted on HBO Canada Monday night and will be repeated from October 9th to 17th. But right now, Kirby Dick joins me on the phone from Los Angeles. Hello, Kirby.
Hi, great to be on your show.
Nice to talk to you. There have been closeted gay politicians for years and years, generations. What's the big deal?
Well, there's nothing, there's really not that much of a deal around somebody being a closeted gay politician. When it becomes important is when they're closeted and they vote anti-gay. Then you have a situation of hypocrisy, and this kind of hypocrisy I think is very important to report on, because what happens is many of these politicians would normally vote pro-gay, but because they're concerned about the information that they are gay getting out to their constituency, they go out of their way to vote anti-gay. And that's how the closet is contorting the political process.
So the people that are most hurt by a closeted gay politician are other gay people.
Exactly. Exactly.
So almost all of the alleged closeted politicians in your film are Republicans. So why don't Democrats appear as prominently in the closet?
Well, because they're, you know, the Democratic Party does not have an anti-gay platform. There are, I believe, I mean, I'm not 100% certain or I would have reported on them, you know, several closeted Democrats who do vote in the, you know, largely anti-gay in Congress. And I looked into them, but I wasn't able to get enough information to really, you know, report on them in my film. But basically, it's because, for the most part, Democrats aren't forced to take an anti-gay position by their party.
Now, you talk about a conspiracy. At the film, the narration states there exists a brilliantly orchestrated conspiracy to keep gay and lesbian politicians closeted as long as possible. Who is behind the conspiracy?
Well, this is not, you know, 10 or 15 people sitting in a room making a decision. It is really, it's sort of a conspiracy between institutions, if you will, between, you know, the political institution, politicians, between the press, where, you know, the press has been aware of this situation and aware of this hypocrisy for many decades and has chosen very deliberately not to report on it, in spite of the fact that the gay press has been reporting on this for over two decades now and has been urging the mainstream media to report on it.
Now, you have a scene in the film where Bill Maher appears on CNN, on Larry King Live, and he says that he's going to out Ken Mellman, who was the 2004 campaign manager for the Bush-Cheney campaign. And then you show the repeat version of that broadcast, the same edition of Larry King, and that claim is cut out by CNN.
Exactly.
So why did that happen?
Well, I mean, I think that's an example of the kind of really censorship that goes on with the mainstream media. I mean, and there's a number of reasons for that. I mean, first of all, maybe less so with CNN, but a lot of mainstream media outlets, most of their viewership or readership is straight, and they oftentimes are afraid of offending a small portion of their readership by reporting on anything that has to do with homosexuality. Perhaps more important is that these news outlets are often owned even by larger corporations that have a lot of business to do in Washington on Capitol Hill, and these corporations have really made the decision that it's they don't want to antagonize a powerful politician by reporting on this kind of hypocrisy.
But they'll report on a scandal. I mean, they were all over the Larry Craig story, and that's really where you start your film. So why a scandal but not the sex life, why the personal life of a politician?
Right. Well, you know, once something is out, I mean, in a scandal, it becomes a feeding frenzy. But what I'm interested more in is the systemic aspect of this. I mean, there are, you know, dozens of closet politicians and perhaps a dozen in D.C. that vote anti-gay. And the press has known about a number of them for a long time. I mean, Mark Foley is one, although Mark Foley didn't vote anti-gay, but the press has known about others. And it's chosen not to report on them.
Michael Rogers, who's a gay blogger, makes it a cause to out gay politicians, and he's featured prominently in your film. How just in terms of making the film, how much of it hinged on the participation of Michael Rogers?
Well, he was extremely important. I mean, he was a man who, you know, he had outed Larry Craig 9 months before Larry Craig was arrested in the Minneapolis bathroom, and at the time that he came forward, because he had spoken to another person who had sex with Larry Craig in a bathroom in Union Station in Washington, D.C., which Union Station is about three blocks from the Capitol. And, you know, in speaking to this person, he realized this person was telling the truth and decided to come forward with this information. When he did come, you know, when he did report on this, of course, a lot of people said this was preposterous. 9 months later, the same thing, a very similar thing happens in Minneapolis, and Mike Rogers is vindicated. But this is what Mike Rogers has devoted his life to for the last five or six years. And it really, I mean, what he did for me is he gave insight into the whole, sort of the underside of this whole process. I mean, he was able to, and also he developed a complete ethic around it in terms of only focusing on, you know, hypocrisy, not just obviously focusing on closeted politicians. And, you know, to date, he's been 100% right.
Let's look at some of the other politicians who you name in this film. New York, former New York Mayor Ed Koch, Florida Governor Charlie Crist, who has repeatedly denied that he's gay. Ed Koch has, I think, historically refused to answer the question. So these politicians are outed. And what about the consequences to you? What about the consequences in terms of legal action that could be taken?
Well, I mean, to begin with, you know, all the information in my documentary is 100% accurate, so I can't really be taken to task for that. Secondly, I think generally these closeted politicians have chosen not to to go after reporting, but to ignore it, really counting on the mainstream media generally not to pick up the story. They've been very successful with that tactic for many years, and in fact, when my film came out, for the most part, that's the way they responded. Charlie Crist didn't respond. Ed Koch did. Ed Koch, you know, said he was outraged by outrage, which, of course, I was very grateful that he mentioned the title of my film twice in his comment, although he did not, again, deny that he was gay. So I'm, you know, there's always a possibility that there could be some lawsuit, that something could happen, but right now nothing has happened to date.
You have a quote from Barney Frank, in of course, openly gay politician in the film. There is a right to privacy, but not a right to hypocrisy. Is the film really more about hypocrisy and the corroding influence of the closet than it is about politics?
Well, yeah, no, exactly. It's about the hypocrisy in you know, this aspect of politics, and you know, hypocrisy is something that I think should be reported on. When it comes to a public official, an elected official, the press should report on hypocrisy whenever they come across it, whether it has to do with, you know, someone, a politician's finances or any of their business activity or anything else that they're involved in, that should be reported on. There are many closeted politicians in D.C., you know, in Congress, who do not vote anti-gay. We were aware of those people, but we didn't report on them because they weren't engaging in hypocrisy.
Right. So in that case, the right to privacy stands.
Right. I mean, I believe in that. I mean, I'm really not particularly interested in you know, a politician's sexual life. I mean, that. One is interested in the way that one is interested in anybody's sexual life. But you know, I don't think this is something that really should distract from the. You know, the very important political issues that are, you know, before us.
No, but there was an ethical
issue of hypocrisy. Then that's different,
right? And there was an ethical debate around the issue of the of outing people who are in the closet, even within the gay community and the gay press, when that started. But all of that changed, I think, when the urgency of the AIDS crisis came.
Right, that was the first thing that changed it, and then it changed again once. You know, the Republicans decided to use this strategy, this anti-gay strategy, and promote these anti-gay marriage initiatives. And I think people realized that there were a lot of politicians who were supporting these initiatives who were closeted, and sometimes supporting these initiatives because they were closeted. That was important to report on. And in fact, Charlie Crist in my film is a prime example. I mean, here you have a politician in the closet. I don't think he wanted to support Amendment 2, which in Florida, which not only outlaws gay marriage, but outlaws civil unions between gays and lesbians, but he chose to because he has national ambition. Here this person again is voting anti-gay to protect the closet because there were a lot of rumors, you know, floating around, Florida. In fact, he chose to get married to squelch those rumors as well.
And do you think would it be possible in the year 2012 for Charlie Crist to be a candidate for president of the United States as a closeted gay man married to a woman?
It's incredible to think of, isn't it? I think more likely he's now running for Senate. He's sort of the front runner, actually, for the Republican nomination for the Senate seat that will become open in 2010, and is favored to win that seat. You know, we'll see what happens, but I think he's sort of taking a different route to the presidency than he you know, considered a couple of years ago.
What does it do to a person's psychology? I want to try and get inside his head. What is it like to live with that magnitude of a falsehood being your entire persona?
Well, you know, in the case of Charlie Crist, I think politicians keep secrets, many secrets. They have to. I mean, everybody is looking for some sort of angle, you know, some sort of way to take them down, and they're always, you know, trying to present the best side of themselves. I actually think he's probably pretty comfortable with his sexuality. I think somebody like Larry Craig, it may be much different. I mean, here's a person who was brought up, you know, in the 50s, and, you know, perhaps his family thought being gay was one of the worst things that could, you know, in the world, really. And so he's brought up in this mindset, and he may be battling it every time he has sex. He may be, you know, and very angry at himself afterwards. That is a psychology that's very fascinating, and that's one of the reasons I chose to make this film, because there's just some very complex psychological things at work here. And in fact, you know, as horrid as the voting records are of some of these closeted politicians, I still feel empathy for them because they too are victims of homophobia. If there weren't homophobia in this society, they would, you know, there would be no pressure on them, and they would just come out and, you know, live their own sexual lives just the way straight politicians do.
Well, there's also Jim McGreevy in your film who is incredibly emotional when he talks about the length that he went to dissemble the truth about himself. He also married, and you have interviews with his wife. What did you make of the emotional state of Jim McGreevy?
Well, I was really grateful that he was, you know, willing to speak so candidly about the difficulty of being in the closet and to really go back and be very specific about his experiences and, you know, the kind of sex he had to have and how that affected him. And because I think that really conveys to an audience the pain that these politicians are going through. Now, this is actually his marriage to his second wife. He did not tell her that he was closeted when he married her, and so she found this out much later. And that's also another kind of pain, and I was very interested in exploring that as well. And Dina McGreevy, his former wife, was very open about that.
One of the things that I was struck by watching this, and particularly when you brought in the quote from Angels in America, where Roy Cohn appears being performed by Al Pacino, the thing that amazed me is how successful many of these people have been. And I think Charlie Crist is probably one of the best examples. An enormous denial going on, and then huge success and reward. Do you think that there's going to be changes? Do you think that this film could help catalyze some of those changes?
I do. I mean, I've talked to a couple of politicians who, after seeing the film, I mean, young politicians who are running in local races, are considering running in local races, have told me that they rather than running as closeted, they chose to run as out, even if it perhaps meant it being less likely that they would win. And I think what the film does is, I mean, people in politics are going to see this film, and particularly people who are younger, in their 20s, when they're going into politics, that is the time they make the decision whether they're going to be out or be closeted. And I think after seeing this film, they're going to realize that it's the wrong decision politically, because there's a great deal of risk, and it's the wrong decision personally, because it's a very painful experience. And they're going to make the choice early on to be out, and then when they get a point in their career where they start running for office, they're going to be out already, and they're going to run as out gay candidates. So I think over the next 10 plus years or so, I think you'll see. I think this film will help, contribute to, at least some demise of the closet in American politics.
It's a fascinating story, Kirby. You tell it really well. Thanks a lot for being with us today on Q.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye.
Kirby Dick is the director of the documentary film Outrage, which airs this week, October 9th, 10th, 13th, 14th, and 17th on HBO Canada. And he joined me by phone from Los Angeles.
This is Q, the podcast, with Gian Gameshi from CBC Radio 1.
Believe it or not, when Happy Days made its debut on ABC back in 1974, Henry Winkler's character, Arthur Fonzarelli, played a minor role in the show, only a handful of lines in the initial run. The network was worried the Fonz would come across as too much of a hoodlum for Happy Days' primetime audience. But the audience fell for Fonzie big time. Eventually, he was so central to the number one show that the network considered renaming it Fonzie's Happy Days. Of course, Fonzie's rise and much of Happy Days' success itself came down to the way Henry Winkler allowed his own personality to shine through the Fonz's tough guy exterior. In the years since Happy Days, Henry Winkler has continued to win over audiences as an actor in dozens of movies and television shows, including Arrested Development. He was very, very funny in that. As a prolific producer and director, and increasingly as a successful children's author. No mean feat for someone who struggled with the written word all of his life and was into his 30s before he was diagnosed as dyslexic. Henry Winkler is spending some time in Canada right now. He's hard at work on the production of an independent comedy called Running Mates in Berks Falls, Ontario. But he's taken some time out to join us here in Studio Q while he's in our neck of the woods. Henry Winkler, hello.
How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm great. I'm happy to be here.
We're really happy to have you with us. You're
Thank
making
you.
A comedy here.
I'm making a comedy with very funny people. Thomas Michael, who could be my son. He's
right.
The same age as my son. He and his best friend, Paolo Mancini, they've been best friends since the fourth grade. They've written this thing together. They star in it together.
Wow.
Thomas Michael is directing it. He is producing it. They have Michael Beaver, DJ Qualls, Graham Greene, who is not only that, but he's also a master chef.
Is he really?
I just want to say we lived in the same B&B together while we were filming, and he made a rack of lamb to rival any restaurant. I'm not kidding. Linda Cash
yep.
Is in it. And the It's just amazing.
Great. And your part is what? What
do you mean? I play the outgoing mayor. I've been mayor for 36 years of this town. Shoulder anywhere in the world. The same town.
Right.
And it is the politics, it is the rivalry of these two running mates, these people who are running to be mayor. Yeah.
You're at a stage in your career where a lot of actors would be moving into serious roles.
Yes.
But you stayed with comedy through most of your acting career.
Yeah, I do. You know, listen, I'm trained to do everything. So comedy, you know, they say that death is hard, dying is hard, comedy is harder.
Yes.
It is true. It is hard to be funny. So when you find a group of people that are enjoying themselves and literally know what's funny, I'm on their bandwagon.
So what's funny to you? What is it that you've seen or experienced recently in terms of other people?
Tina Fey is funny.
Yeah.
Tina Fey is
absolutely
funny. You know, the Francis Verbe, I think that's his name, the French director.
Mm-hmm.
He directed La Cage aux Folles. He wrote La Cage aux Folles.
Right.
Les Compères and The Goat. There was, I forget what it was called in French, but it was, you know. But those three films are, I think, brilliantly funny.
Do you speak French?
I don't. But I read the subtitle and laughed as loud. I'm not kidding.
You're also, while you're here, you're going to be talking about something that has to do with your own experience, and that's your experience of growing up with dyslexia.
Yes.
And understanding, coming to an understanding very late in life,
right,
that you had a disability.
I was 31 when I found out that I had a learning challenge, and I have written a series of books called Hank Zipser, The World's Greatest Underachiever. They're for kids from 7.5 to 12. Reluctant readers who have never read a book, read these, laugh out loud, and read five.
But was that you? Are you Hank?
I am Hank. He lives in my building. He lives in my apartment. He goes to my PS 87, you know, in New York City. Miss Adolph, the worst teacher in the world, was my teacher, and I'm sure she was related. I'm not kidding. Do you know that I raised my hand in the fourth grade to go to the boys' room? I am still waiting for that woman to call on me. She was no joke.
So, but what was that? If that had been diagnosed when you were Hank's age,
right,
if you'd been treated, or if somebody had understood, or you
right
didn't have Miss Adolph, do you think your life would have been a whole lot different?
You know what? It's very possible. I used to think that I would love to have cut the dyslexia, the learning challenge, out of my brain, just scooped it out with a spoon and threw it away. I wish that I could have done that. And then I realized, maybe I would not be sitting here talking to you if I didn't have that struggle,
right,
if I didn't have to fight through the enormity of not being able to spell, not being able to read. Math is impossible. History is impossible. I was brilliant at lunch. I'm not kidding. I was really good at that.
But what about your parents? Like your mom and dad, they must have thought,
my
Henry
parents,
is no good in school. He's not working. He's
my
not
parents
applying
escaped
himself.
Nazi Germany.
Yeah.
They were very, very severe human beings. Do you know? They believed in education, didn't know that there was such a thing as dyslexia. Had no idea. Just thought that I was lazy. They had an affectionate phrase for me growing up called Dummer Hund. Now, for those of you who don't speak German that are listening, that means dumb dog. Very supportive people. And they literally grounded me for 6 weeks at a time, thinking if I sat at my desk long enough, I was going to get it.
Were you hurt by that?
You know what? For the longest time, my self-image was down around my ankles. And what I say now to any child who will bear with me is that no matter how you learn, no matter at what rate you learn, you have greatness in you. It doesn't matter that you're not good at school. It has nothing to do with how brilliant you are.
Do you ever think that the vulnerability that your famous character
Arthur Fonzarelli had with the tough exterior came out of that experience
you
had as a child.
I'm sure it did, because what was important to me about the Fonz was not only was he in charge, which I never was in my life. You know, when I called a girl, I would put on an overcoat in the middle of August because I was so nervous. I was shaking. You know, I had to calm down. But he was not only in charge, but he was loyal to his friends. He depended on his friends. He needed his friends as much as they needed him.
Did your parents come around when you found success?
Yeah,
and
but
you
know
found
what?
Enormous success with
That's
that character.
That's a great question, because I didn't care at that time. It was too late.
Yeah.
I needed them to support me early on.
Right.
And I needed them to give me some sort of recognition just for being born and that I was breathing and not constantly find something wrong, you know. So I just made a decision that I was going to be a different dad.
But was it fulfilling for you when you achieved that success yourself and you were arguably the most successful actor on television at that point?
It's true, isn't it?
Was that fulfilling for you?
That was fulfilling for me. I didn't care that it was fulfilling for them.
Right.
Do you know, my parents didn't want me to be an actor. They wanted me to take over the family business, which was importing and exporting wood. You know, like I like a chair like anybody else, but I mean, what do I care about wood? But when I became an actor and the Fonz took off, all of a sudden they became the co-producers of Henley Winkler. Yeah, wir Fonzie's parents. How do you do? I've met people all over the world who said, hey, I've got your parents' autograph.
Wow.
Yeah.
So did you make peace with them in the end?
No, it took me a long... I think I made peace with them last Thursday.
Okay.
And they passed on to the other side in 1998, you know?
You know, you were so great in Arrested Development, and
Thank you.
Seems to me to be a program that's about the future of television. It seems like a television show from the future.
Right.
Do you think that it is it an anomaly? Is it an outlier? Or do you think that it is going to set the bar for future shows to come?
Well, you know, I'll tell you something. There are very few people as brilliant as Mitch Hurwitz, who was the creator and the head writer of that show, the executive producer. It all came out of his brain, do you know? He would come down to the set and he would go, you know, I think this would be funny. And then you would just do it.
Because you knew he was right.
Because you knew he was right. You just never questioned him.
So what was it that you liked about the character that you played?
Oh, he was so idiosyncratic. And to this moment, still has no idea what his sexuality is. Do you know? I'm not kidding. I think he wears chiffon underwear under his suit when he's a lawyer in court.
I wish we'd seen it. You should have revealed it at some point.
You know what? Maybe in the movie.
So you will be in the movie then?
Well, you know what? I'm hoping. You never know.
Okay.
I'm hoping that I am. If everybody writes to Mitch Hurwitz... then in California, maybe I'll be in that movie.
I want to get back to you said about being.
I mean,
great...
how much can you see of Will Arnett? Do you know?
Yeah,
he's got a great voice and everything.
Yeah,
you know, he's got a new son. What does he need to be in the movie for?
You talked about being a great dad yourself.
Yeah,
your son.
Well,
Max,
wanting to be, yeah.
But he's in the business.
Son is a director. At this moment, as we're talking, he is finalizing production to start his first movie that he wrote and will direct in New York City.
That's great.
Now ask me if he's hired me.
Yes, he hired you.
I don't talk to him anymore.
You got all these family issues.
It's amazing. My daughter is a teacher.
Yeah.
My daughter, each one of my children is dyslexic because it's hereditary. It's passed on, you know. But we jumped on them right away, and they are incredible citizens of the world.
Yeah.
My daughter is a preschool teacher. She is gifted with the wounded bird. And my oldest is expecting with his wife their first child at the end of this month, as a matter of fact.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So that would be your first grandchild?
Yes. That's why I'm gray.
That's...
I didn't know you. If you call somebody grandfather, then immediately they turn gray.
Overnight.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
I was blonde yesterday.
But it's true. When a child has something right in front of them and they know it's there and they know what it is, if it's an obstacle, they find the way around it.
Yes.
And that's, that support is so important.
But you know what? It, that is so true. It is the resiliency of the human being. That's why I say, look, it does not matter if you're having a hard time with your academics or not. So, certainly it's the law. You've got to go to school. But when you are out of school, you meet your destiny, you will soar like an eagle. You know, I was told I would never achieve. I was told that I was lazy, that I was, you know, just not living up to my potential. And I've had the most wonderful life.
But your the concept for Fonzie was your concept. It wasn't what Gary Marshall imagined for that part.
No, they imagined a much, you know, a much larger human being. I was the shortest tough maybe in history, except for James Cagney. But you, that's what an actor does. You don't just fill time and space.
Right.
You fill it with your imagination, with your take on it. That's why every actor that does the same role is completely different. You know, because you bring your uniqueness.
What's it like for you? If you're watching Nick at Night or something, an episode of Happy Days comes on, will you watch it?
It's delightful. I, you know what? And here it is. And not because I was just on the show. I truly believe if they put Happy Days on at 8 o'clock on a weekday, that it would find an audience in the same exact way it did originally. That children who found it then will find it today.
Really, you don't think in the age of cynicism that we live in now with text messaging
and I think just because of that, the simplicity of it, and you know, Gary Marshall was brilliant. He put it in the 50s because he told the same moral story that is told in almost every in every show.
Right.
But he said it in a time when it didn't seem like you were being hit on the head by the thought of the story.
Did you ever feel that the series, as they say, jumped the shark?
No. You know, jumped the shark, you, that's America for you. Jump the shark happened. We were number one for the next 4 or 5 years after that anyway.
Let's just review this for people who might not understand. But this was an episode of Happy Days.
Where we went to California. The everybody from Milwaukee flew to California, and the Fonz went water skiing and jumped over a shark.
So this guy claims that that was the point at which the series stopped being a serious series.
You know, it's the
parody.
Tipping point.
Yeah.
It's when it's something has moved over to the other side, do you know? And I don't believe that that was true about our show.
So the show continued after that?
It continued to be number one. You know, we were number one for 9 years, 9.5 years. The only competition that literally put a dent into our rating was the A-Team.
Carrie Fisher says she'll always be Princess Leia.
Here's
somebody with enormous talent, very, very funny person.
Yes, but she's doing a Broadway play, I believe, a one-woman show coming up.
Absolutely. She's absolutely great.
Yeah.
But it's funny because when she says that, she doesn't say it with contempt. She obviously is at peace with that.
Yeah. I love the fact that, listen, we were number one in 126 countries. So no matter where I go in the world, somebody invites me to their home for dinner. Can you beat that?
That's great. And then they show you your parents' autograph.
Absolutely. It's amazing. They have it framed in the living room.
Are there comic roles that you haven't played yet that you're waiting for the chance still?
No, because I never know what's coming. Do you know? Here I'm sitting in my home. I get a call. I'm asked to be in Running Mates, which is the movie I just finished in Berks Falls. Meanwhile, if you've ever been or have never been to Berks Falls, it is so beautiful up there. The leaves are changing.
Yeah.
I stayed at the Village Manor run by Louisa Moffett,
who also has a
construction company,
yeah,
who also is a realtor, who also is a grandmother of nine.
Wow.
What a woman.
Listen, thank you very much for being our guest on Q.
I loved being here.
A pleasure to meet you.
Yeah,
you're
thanks.
A very funny person.
Thank you. And you know what? The holiday season is just like a few months away. So a little early, let me be the first to say, have a safe, wonderful holiday season.
Oh, we sure will. Henry Winkler here in Studio Q. Keep an eye out for Running Mates, the independent comedy he is currently shooting in Berks Falls, Ontario.
This is Q, the podcast. We're on CBC Radio 1 twice each weekday, 10 a.m. and 10 p.m., 10:30 in Newfoundland. Or check out Q with pictures, QTV, at youtube.com/QTV.
It's time now for a micro visit, a quick time chat with Mio Edelman. He is Q's dot commentator, dot netizen, and all round dot bon vivant. And while the man might blog his digital discoveries in an uppercase voice, his weekly web reports are always delivered on the download down low.
Who's got the links that are too hot to handle?
Too hot to handle.
I'm your boy with the high speed connection.
The high speed connection.
Shoddy, grab your laptop and listen to Mio. And listen to Mio.
This is the download.
Hey, Mia, how you doing?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm just great. I just talked to the Fonz.
I know.
Are you kidding?
I know.
I can't believe it.
I'm so jealous of you.
What a great guy.
Yeah. Was he wearing his leather jacket?
Yeah, he had the leather jacket. It's a little bit creaky now, but it's still there. It's shiny. What's up? What's on the download?
Well, it was a weird, it was kind of a weird up and down kind of week. It was very sort of slow, and I was sitting, Gian makes me sit in a room at my house just by myself, and he won't, I'm supposed to just sit there until I find something, you know, and I was just like, you know, forget about this. Gian's going on vacation. So you know what I did? I took a nap.
Oh, good.
I didn't want to push it. I was just like, you know what? I'm going to take a nap. The internet comes and goes. It giveth and it taketh away.
You know, sleep deprivation is a definition of torture.
So exactly.
You got to fight back.
Exactly. So I went and took a nap. I felt well rested after a couple hours. I came back and I was horrified to find two things. One, you've probably heard of the Stephen Harper playing the piano, get high. I want to know what kind of drugs, what is he getting high on, and who's he getting high with?
His friends, obviously.
Well, his friends. Well, that's the thing. Is Jim Flaherty sitting there with a bong? Are they hanging? It was kind of.
I would go more Minister of Health because they're in charge medical marijuana.
Yes, right. The dispensary. But then, even more troubling. This is unbelievable. I came across this. I was looking for blogs. I've been looking for. This is sort of the theme of the year is looking for blogs, substantial blogs. And I came across this blog called yarnbombing.com. Have you heard about this new urban trend, yarn bombing?
No, but it sounds, yarn bombing, it sounds like terrorist grandmothers.
Exactly. Knit gorillas.
Yeah.
Yarn ninjas. Basically, you know, graffiti, right? People spray paint chalk. There are people who are knit graffiti artists who, instead of spray painting places, will now cover things in public with yarn, with their knitwear. So, for instance, a tree will suddenly, you will walk out your door and a tree will have a sweater, or a parking meter will have a balaclava. Apparently, this is happening all over the world now. It's horrifying.
No, wait, why is this horrifying? As long as it's all natural fabrics, it sounds like it might be kind of a nice thing.
Well, this is the thing. Not only is it all natural fabrics, but it's also, because it's colorful, they say it's beautification as opposed to, some people have a real problem with graffiti because it's rude or this sort of thing. But it's the same thing. People are just going up. Can you imagine walking out your door? Do you have a tree in front of your house?
I do have a tree. And it doesn't need to be beautified.
Right, exactly, because a tree is a tree.
It's a tree.
And all of a sudden, your tree has a sweater that you didn't buy for it. It's like, who's dressing my tree? This is craziness. Furthermore, this blog, yarnbombing.com, is put together by two Vancouver women, Mandy Moore and Leanne Prain. Not Mandy Moore, Mandy Moore.
Right, okay.
And wool, right? Vancouver is a little bit wet. You know, it happens all over the world, but Vancouver is quite wet. Can you imagine what wool outdoors in the rain will smell? Like an entire city? It's horrifying.
But just back up for a second. Yeah. You know, a tree, yeah. I don't think a tree needs to be beautified. It certainly doesn't need like a letter sweater on it. Mm. But you know, there's a fire hydrant in front of my house.
Yes.
I walk by the fire hydrant. The fire hydrant's screaming at me, Fentex me. Fentex me, please. Certainly there is room. Isn't there room for, for improvement of some urban installations?
Listen, Brent, I mean, if that's your thing, if you want your fire hydrant to be wearing some wool or some rayon, whatever, like whatever quality that you want, even maybe some alpaca, perhaps some cashmere, that's entirely up to you. And you can, if you go to this website, you can learn, because it's not just about knitting, right? It's also about how to surreptitiously put this on, because you don't want to get caught. Right, you want to be a ninja. You want to be a yarn ninja. So if you want to do that, if you want to join the movement, go ahead. I just don't want this is the problem.
What is the penalty for yarn bombing? I mean,
I don't think anything's been legislated yet. I mean, it's possible.
But you go into those gray areas that the CIA controls.
Maybe
obviously.
There's a fine. Maybe you're not allowed to use knitting needles, or crochet. You're not allowed to. You can't knit and purl for like 6 months. You have to go to a parole officer or something. But the problem for me is I'm actually allergic to wool.
Oh.
So I think synthetics
all around for you then.
Exactly. Well, cotton. I mean, like, they've got nice cotton weaves now, I'm not an expert. Who knows? But, like, I was in grade 8 or something, and I put on a pair of wool gloves, and my hands, they swelled up. They swole up. It was terrible. Anyway, I'm just saying, like, if you're into it, that's fine. I mean, there are people out there who are really into this.
Is it just Vancouver, or is it?
No, it's all over the world. It started in Texas. These women have just got smart and got the yarn bomb. They came out with a book called Yarn Bombing the Book.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
As if I need to be told it's a book, but nonetheless, yeah. Check it out.
I've been crochet free for 6 months, and I don't mind saying it. I tell everyone, I'm over it.
I can tell.
I'm jonesing a little bit, but I'm holding in. Mio, great to meet you. Thank you very much for being us.
Thanks a lot.
That's Mio Edelman, and you can catch more of Mio's crazy downloads in his newest entry at the Q blog at cbc.ca/Q.
This is Q, the podcast. We're on CBC Radio 1 twice a day at 10 a.m. and 10 p.m., 10:30 in Newfoundland.
Chris Rock, Sarah Jessica Parker, Robert De Niro, John Fogerty of Creedence Clearwater Revival, just some of the fans, along with their kids, of Australian preschool entertainers, The Wiggles. There's a groove that people older than toddlers can get into. The color-coded quartet formed about 18 years ago when Murray Cook, Anthony Field, and Greg Page met at university. They were studying to be preschool teachers. Jeff Fatt, a former bandmate of Cook's, joined the ranks, and that was the Wiggles' first wave. They had that 60s-flavored groove thing going. They made entreaties to look both ways before crossing the street and to create healthy fruit salads. And the Wiggles hit big with the toddler set. In fact, the Wiggles' worldwide success has been so great. They've sold more than 23 million DVDs, 7 million CDs, and they tour their live show regularly, cranking out hundreds of shows a year. They outrank stars like AC/DC, Nicole Kidman, and Russell Crowe as Australia's richest export. Massively successful. Today, we have all four Wiggles in studio. Red, Murray Cook. Hello.
Hello.
Purple, Jeff Fatt. Hello, Jeff.
Oh, he's asleep.
Wake up, Jeff.
Hi.
Blue, Anthony Field.
Good day.
And yellow, Sam Morin.
That's it.
Hi. Hello. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
It's a pleasure to have the Wiggles here with me in studio. Anthony, I know that the Wiggles came out of a very serious endeavor, a school project, actually. What was the beginning of all of this for you?
Yes, well, Anthony and I and Greg, who is no longer with us, I mean, he's still with us, but he's not with us. He's moved on.
Yeah.
We're at university studying to be early childhood teachers, and Anthony and I taught for a couple of years. And we kind of had this ongoing project, I guess, that Anthony came up with to do an album of music for children, and using what we'd learned about the way children think and using music with children. And we thought we were just doing a one-off album of music. We didn't think it was a career, but it's continued on. And
so Anthony, when did it first occur to you that there was a sort of megatronic effect to what you were doing?
It never did, really. I was really interested in early childhood music, and I collect a lot of folk music while I was doing the early childhood course. And Murray was right into music, and Greg was right into music, so we sort of gravitated towards each other. And also, we were only three males in a university. Really, there was 180 women in our year, and there wasn't many men doing early childhood, so we had kind of a lot in common. And I was saying to the guys, we should do a early childhood music album, because I was right into it, and I wanted to do a good album, because we had the philosophy that we could do an album which children would understand. That was what I wanted to do, and that's what the guys wanted to do, just a good album for children.
And that obviously that album was very successful, but looking back on it now, does it seem like a school project to you?
Well, at the time, we were just so entrenched in early childhood education that we wanted to do something that was worthwhile for children. It wasn't anything commercial. It wasn't.
So in a way, the spirit we started it in, we've continued to. We always do try to make what we produce as appropriate for children as we can, and that's kind of more important in a lot of ways than commercial considerations. And so in some ways, yeah, if it started like a school project, it's kind of continued like that for just, you know, over many years.
It's continued like that, but now there's this enormous success attached to it, and you know, it really does seem to me when I read about some of the stuff that goes on that you guys are living the kind of kiddie version of A Hard Day's Night. I mean, is there some truth to that? Do you have that same sense of being in a pursuit of having to kind of build a wall around yourselves to protect yourselves from fans? And I don't want to put too fine a point on that, but simply to preserve the personal side of your lives.
I guess when we're especially in Australia, because we've been there for so long and we've been going for so long in Australia, that a lot of kids have grown up with us, so you do get a lot of attention in the streets sometimes. But mostly, you know, mostly we can walk around, and it's not really like A Hard Day's Night in that sense. But
didn't you have to put up on your website you didn't want parents to track you down because it was being disrupt your schedule?
There was a little bit of that for a while. They'd often wait for us at the hotels and things, and that was kind of
so
a
that sounds like A Hard Day's Night.
Yeah, I guess there was a little bit of that. Yeah. But in a smaller way, I guess we weren't being pursued down the street.
Okay, I got to do this again. Wake up, Jeff. Because Jeff, that's the tell us the story of that catchphrase.
I received the Wake Up, Jeff mantle because it was a way of getting me involved on stage without having to actually do anything. I mean, I didn't have the early childhood teacher preschool training.
You were just a musician?
Yeah. I mean, I played in the...
Good musician.
Thank you. I played in a rock band called The Cockroaches with Anthony all through the 80s. And I can remember Anthony used to cart around his children's music albums with him in the twilight days of The Cockroaches. And he'd play those in the car.
Did you dig it? Did you think that was... Cool stuff.
Interesting. He's got a very diverse range of musical tastes, so that was just part of it.
Okay. Now, can we listen to? We have a little bit of the Cockroaches here, don't we? Let's go back. Can we go back in time?
Ooh, you got Cockroaches.
Oh, we have everything here. Let's take a listen to the early days of Anthony and Jeff, and this is the Australian rock band, the Cockroaches. Now you got to tell me, why is that song not a song for children's? Why would that not be a children's entertainment song?
Only lyrics. Lyrics. Children will respond to all sorts of music. You know, they're more open to music than we are. But the lyrics. It's all about she's the one. It's about a girl. So if you've made it about food or something in the children's world, they'd be right into it.
Is it true when you first started to appeal to the North American market that somebody told you that your Australian accents would be completely indecipherable to children?
We faced that when we first came to the States, but we were really happy that we didn't change and that parents were pretty open to it, you know, and Canada too. And reverse in Australia, we have all North American shows on, and our children are exposed to, you know, Sesame Street, Blue's Clues, and all that. So for us, we thought, reverse it. Then again, a lot of parents have been complaining that their children are saying banana.
Sam, you took over for Greg Page, who's one of the band's founders. So how did you audition for this gig?
Oh, I had been Greg's understudy on the road for about 5 years as the singer of the group. He needs somebody in case he had couldn't sing on that day. There needed to be somebody to stand in. And Greg had started to, over a period of that 5 years, progressively, his illness, which forced him to leave the group, had progressively gotten worse and worse. I had to fill in more and more. Yeah. So it's about 3 years ago I took over from Greg, and it's been... it's been great.
And I understand you decided to be very upfront about what happened with Greg. How did you handle that?
We figured that the best thing was just to be honest, and children respond to that. They understand sickness and it's, you know, something that parents can work through with their children and talk about it, and it's part of life. So we were very open about it. Even at our shows, we had at our live shows, we had a video of Greg handing over the yellow shirt to Sam, and I think people felt that there was a bit of closure there, and just the honesty of it, I think people appreciated.
The only thing which is strange for children is that Greg still is on Treehouse, and yeah. Sam comes on, and so for children, it's kind of an abstract concept that he's not there because he really is there on television.
Yeah,
So it's a funny one. I've got little preschool children myself, and they just talk about the Sam Wiggles or the Greg Wiggles.
That must be so powerful for your kids, though, to be able to go into their preschool and say, you know what, my dad's a Wiggle.
It's not really a children's concept, Dad. It's not really...
That kind of bragging thing that little kids don't really do that. They don't kind of think, oh, my dad's famous. I've only really had it... My children are in high school now, and it's a bigger deal now than it was when they were little.
You use it to get dates and stuff.
Well, they don't, but it causes a real stir. And their age in Australia have grown up with the Wiggles. So a few of my daughter's friends didn't know that her... My daughter's dad was the Wiggle.
When you get teenagers, it's quite cool. My nephew Luke, he borrowed the big red car for his year 12 formal. It's a, what do they call it?
Prom.
Senior prom.
Was he insured for that? Or
they just took it up on a tow truck and he just drove it to make the grand entrance. It's pretty cool.
Who'd have thought the Wiggles would ever be cool?
I think we're so uncool that we're cool.
Yeah, that's right. When you hear stuff, when you just heard the Cockroaches, do you ever think that you'd like to be making music for adults? That would be, that might be as rewarding or more rewarding?
I think I'm not really sure if it could be as rewarding. We go out on stage every day and see thousands of smiling children and having a great time, and then see the parents smiling at having a great time watching their children have such a great time. So I don't know what could be really more rewarding than that. Really,
and also coming from the Cockroaches, we had a record label that would tell us, they were looking over our shoulders going, you've got to make it hard.
With
the Wiggles, we've done every style of music known to humanity. We've done folk songs from all around the world. We've done rock music. We've done classical music. We've done
South American songs.
We've done songs in different languages, French and Italian.
It's more liberating.
It's
cool, really.
There's a lot of freedom in and also we've tried to maintain control over what we do. So we decide what we're going to do.
So in a way, we do make music for adults and for children, but it's just the lyrics are different, and we don't have 10-minute guitar solos. Sam's doing a solo album at the moment, so you obviously need to. There are sort of
How do you find time? Because you're doing how many dates have you done as a week this year?
How I find the time actually, but I've just finished recording it actually. But it is an album for adults, and I guess as a performer. It gives you an opportunity to explore some adult emotions as in addition to the child themes that we deal with. So,
this is a general question, but I'd love it if you could give me a specific answer. What is the magic formula for holding a child's attention? And what is the thing that you do? What's the thing to avoid if you don't want to lose it?
Well, I think being what in early childhood circles you call being child-centered. So thinking about what interests the child, not thinking about just an adult concept of what a child should hear. Or sometimes I think there's very worthy sorts of songs out there for children, maybe about the environment and things like that. But sometimes a lot of the times they're expressed in ways that have no interest for children at all. So you've got to really be child-centered, think about what's in it for the child. And then keeping them involved is really important. We try to have a lot of songs where there's actions or dances for them to do. So that's a real key too. So they feel like they're part of it. They have some ownership of the music as well, and that they don't feel that it's just being played to them. They're part of the whole experience.
Have you ever done something you thought, this is going to be great, it's going to work, they're going to love it, and of course, as soon as you started, it just totally went into the dump?
Yeah, the famous... We call it the crash and burn. I thought it was a great idea to have a Dorothy question time where children can ask Dorothy the dinosaur on stage a question, but what happened is children just looked up and said, oh, I'm five, I'm four, I've got a dog. We really scratched our heads, and we went back to our university lecturer, Professor Kath Warren, and asked her, and she said, you made the big mistake where children under five really don't understand what a question is, that concept. Huh. But if you change that to Dorothy's News Time, have you got news for Dorothy? Then it all fits. So the next concert we did was Dorothy's News Time. Have you got some news for Dorothy? I'm five. That's it. I've got a dog.
That's adorable. So it really was, we
pitched. And a lot of times when we go to TV stations and they have an interviewer who says to the children, have you got a question for the Wiggles? And they don't because right. they don't understand what a question is right, or how right, to ask right, a question.
Right. Oh, that's really, really cute. That's something. Now, it feels like there's less competition in this field. Like we were talking about music earlier and being in a band and the whole idea of a record label. But in this field, are you writing your own sort of destiny? Are you deciding what's going to happen? Or is there a template of a career that you can follow?
No, there's not. And it's different to rock and roll where radio is everything. You don't get radio airplay
right.
at all. You're on the TV, which is very important. Or how we did it in Australia was just touring and touring and touring. But it is because the Wiggles we came up with it ourselves and it's our own concept. Well, we chart where we go, you know, let's do some theatre, let's do DVDs or, you know, so, yeah.
Yeah, there, I mean, there's obviously children's performers out there, and you know, Canada has a lot like Raffi and Sharon Lawson and Bram, and so there is, in some senses, there's some forebears, but I think what we did is really quite different to what other people have done, and so yeah, well, I think we kind of have written some of the rules ourselves.
So how do you look at the next 5 or 10 years? Do you have an idea of where you want to go next, what you want to do? Because it seems like you couldn't be more successful.
Well, we've actually started. We've got our own TV studio in Australia, which we've only had for the last two years. And we've started producing other children's TV, which has been really interesting, a real challenge and exciting. Our live shows have gone absolutely crazy. We're now doing a lot of circus type of stuff, acrobatics. And so we've kind of... we're evolving as we go. It's not just the same as it was 10 years ago, you know. So, and of course, when Sam took over, his voice is different to Greg's and it's a different style. So that, again, was a real challenge for us to make it natural and to make it all work, you know, because what we did with Greg was incredible. And so trying to live up to that's been a real challenge for us.
Yeah. So what do you think your lasting legacy is going to be then?
Fruit salad, yummy, yummy.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be great?
Well, I just think it'd be great if some of our songs are sung by families, you know, in years to come, even if people forget who the Wiggles were. Yeah. But if the songs last, I think that would be a real joy.
The Wiggles are about to hit the road across Canada. Would you like to tell your fans which hotels you'll be staying at so they can drop by and maybe review some lyrics with you? It's been a pleasure to meet you. Keep doing what you're doing. It's fabulous stuff. Thank you very much for being with us on Q.
Thank you.
I've been talking to the Wiggles, Murray Cook, Jeff Fatt, Anthony Field, and Sam Morin. They kick off their Wiggles Go Bananas tour in Vancouver on Friday. And then over the next 2 months, they'll touch down in British Columbia, Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, and Ontario. For dates, visit their website, thewiggles.com.au.
All right, well, you've been listening to Q, the podcast. You can hear Q, the program, every weekday morning and evening at 10 a.m. and 10 p.m. on CBC Radio 1 and Sirius Satellite 137. I'm Gian Gameshi. Thanks very much for listening.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.